Blog Talk Radio.
Blessings, blessings and greetings, everyone. Blessed souls. That was the Moody Blues with the story in your eyes, because the story in each human eye cannot tell a lie, because it's configured to the divine image, the Tzelem Elokim. Good morning, everyone. This is the 73rd class of Soul Class. Soul being an acronym for S7O, oldest U, universal L laws, alluding to the seven axiomatic eternal Noahide commandments. Number one, not to blaspheme the Creator with the Creator's name. Number two, not to serve or get engaged in idolatry. Number three, not to commit premeditated acts of murder. Number four, not to engage in acts of idolatry. Adultery. We mentioned idolatry before. Not to engage in adultery. Number five, not to eat the limb of an animal that's still alive. And number six, Ron, are you there?
Yeah, good morning. How are you?
Yeah, good morning, good morning. I got a little slip of the tongue because I was so into the music. You know, I was listening to the Moody Blues, and I was thinking, wow, those guys are not Moody Jews. They're joyous Noahides with that music like that. Also, we have Dennis Ryan. Dennis, good morning, our advocate and learner and teacher of Maimonides' Guide to the Perplexed. Good morning, Dennis.
Good morning, Don. Good morning, Ron.
Good morning, Dennis.
Okay.
How are you?
Okay, I hope the
morning.
Okay. I just want to reiterate, gentlemen, the seven Noahide commandments, because I think I messed up that first presentation. Let's start again. So again, blessed souls, the seven universal Noahide commandments are: number one, not to blaspheme the name of the Creator, not to blaspheme the Creator with one of his names or primal name, which is known as the Yud and the Hey and the Vav and the Hey; two, not to commit acts of idolatry; number three, not to commit premeditated murder; number four, not to commit acts of adultery; number five, not to steal. Oh, I think I'm getting it right now. Number six, not to eat the limb of an animal while it's still alive. Number seven, to raise up righteous statutes in every land. to reflect the Creator's plan that this world was created to be a settled place. Gentlemen, before we get into the meat of the program, I'd like to share with you and blessed listening audience, by the way, anyone that wants to call in for a some commentary, feedback, comments, questions, and concerns, you can call into our hookup guest call number at 1-347-838-8669. That's again 1-347-838-8669. But Dennis and Ron and Dennis, I'd like to share with you an article that was written by a friend of mine on Facebook. His name is Rudy Stettner. That's R-U-D-I and then S-T-E-T-T-N-E-R. And this, there was a recent decision made by the Supreme Court, and as I just mentioned, one of the Noahide commandments is to erect or allow to manifest righteous judgments in the land. In general, I'm going to read the article very slowly, and for those who are interested in learning more of the nice, insightful writings of Rudy Stettner, you can go to http://globe.info, where you can get a host of articles written by this thoughtful young man. So, gentlemen, let's get into this article, and I'd love to hear what you guys have to say about this. So this article is entitled Junked Justice from Supreme Court, Wrongful Imprisonment Award Tossed. And here comes the story, gentlemen. A $14 million award for wrongful imprisonment to a death row inmate has been reversed in a decision by the U.S. Supreme Court. John Thompson spent 18 years in prison for a murder of which he was later exonerated. He was cleared of the charge. He was on death row for 14 of those years with evidence that would have freed him willfully withheld by the prosecution. The legal doctrine that formed the basis of John Thompson's suit was the denial of his Brady rights. What are the Brady rights? A legal principle that the prosecution must turn over to the defense all evidence in their possession that would prove the innocence of the accused. Mr. Thompson was convicted of the murder of Raymond Luaza, Jr. in 1985. Shortly prior to that, he was convicted of an attempted armed robbery, a conviction that made him eligible for the death penalty in the Luaza murder. A test of blood left by the perpetrator of the armed robbery proved that Thompson could not have been the perpetrator. This later led to the reversal of Thompson's conviction in this case. In the murder itself, there were critical discrepancies in eyewitness accounts that were not shared with the defense. Most importantly, a description of the murderer as having close-cropped hair did not match the afro worn by Thompson at the time of the murder. On the base of shoddy representation and the prosecution in New Orleans holding back critically relevant evidence, John Thompson lost 18 years of his life. Now, the logic of the Supreme Court denying Thompson his monetary award was penned by Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas and read as follows. I'm going to read a quotation from the decision of Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas. Quote, prosecutors are not only equipped but are also ethically bound to know what Brady entails. As we mentioned before, that's a law. Let me just go back a little bit here. The Brady rights. So again, prosecutors are not only equipped but also ethically bound to know what Brady entails and to perform legal research when they are uncertain, unquote, Thomas said. Quote again from Thomas, a district attorney is entitled to rely on prosecutors' professional training and ethical obligations in the absence of specific reasons, such as the pattern of violations, to believe that those tools are insufficient to prevent future constitutional violations. So Stettner went on to say, the liberal justices on the Supreme Court disagreed. Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg said that John Thompson deserved compensation for, quote, the gross, deliberately indifferent, and long-term violation of his fair trial rights, unquote. So what it comes down to, gentlemen, is that Stettner concluded the final two paragraphs. Thompson will get $150,000 for his 18 years in prison, which is a little more than $9,000 for each year behind bars. The $14 million he had been previously awarded was large enough to express the horror felt by society that an innocent man could be deprived of his liberty for 18 years. failing to hold the criminal justice system responsible for its misdeeds, incompetence, and massive human suffering caused by such prosecutorial malfeasance undermines the public's respect for criminal justice system. Common decency would dictate that John Thompson be richly rewarded for his 18 years in prison. Each and every moment was a crime perpetrated against Thompson in the name of the people of Louisiana. Although my sympathies generally run towards conservatives in the legislature and in the courts, I am deeply troubled and ashamed that, quote-unquote, the conservatives, in this case, joined to weigh against common decency. In the history of the Supreme Court, this decision will go down as one of the most shameful decisions. John Thompson and the people of the United States deserve better. Dennis, would you like to weigh in on this article?
Yes. Justice. Can we find it? Do we seek it? Does it exist? Unfortunately, the Greeks, going back to Aristotle, Plato, and Socrates, especially Plato in the Republic, said, and most of the Greeks agreed originally, that if you want justice for all, you're lucky to get it for about 90% of the time. The other 10% just goes off the board. It doesn't exist. You can't get it. If you think you can get justice equally for every individual on this planet, it's not going to happen. So, unfortunately, I'm reporting on this. I don't necessarily agree with it, but it becomes a fact of life. And we must understand life may not be fair. I mean, if you want to go back to Scripture, take Job. Did he think it was all fair? But he lasted through it. He kept saying, why me, Lord? And I don't know if he ever got an answer, but I hope he found it in heaven somewhere. But anyway, the Supreme Court is one of those arbitrary or conventional things set up by humans, especially in this country, to be the arbiter or the decider of things. And if we don't decide it, we're going to leave it up in the air. So rather than leave it up in the air, we draw a line. That line may not be fair. It may not be just. However, the courts do not necessarily go after prosecutors, government prosecutors, no matter what they do, because they're the final upholders of justice, so to speak. So what happens is the courts usually lay off being 100% fair when prosecutors are involved. Now, we've had several cases in the last couple of weeks. Steiner, the fellow you just mentioned, is one of them. There was another one that just came out a couple of days ago from the Ninth District Court out in the West there, where the Supreme Court reversed it, and the guy is entitled to nothing almost, even though he thought he was going to make $14, $15, $16 million.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure his lawyers encouraged him. And in all fairness, why can't we spread around the money? However, what they said was if the prosecutors made a mistake or somebody inadvertently on their staff have withheld important evidence, etc., that's the way it goes. And we're not going to go back and try to undo every little thing in the world. So if you have faith that you will be saved, that's 10 times more important than the faith that you believe that you can make a lot of money based on legal misdeeds or legal incompetence. The world just doesn't work that way, unfortunately.
Right. Ron, would you like to weigh in on this, what I would say, a gross miscarriage of justice against Mr. Thompson?
I'm not too familiar with the system here in America and exactly how it works. But one thing I can tell you is that I saw a program once where a young man was actually imprisoned for a rape in which he did not commit. And while being imprisoned, he actually encountered the actual rapist who was bragging about his deeds.
Wow.
But for him to receive a retrial with the new DNA evidence and everything, he had to sign that he would not pursue the legal system. And for him, his freedom was more important than, you know, pursuing the legal system. So he was exonerated. The thing is, when he came out, he had such a positive view of that whole situation. He said, you know, for the time I was imprisoned, most of my friends that I, my colleagues that I associated with have died. The guy even got killed or became drug addict or whatever it is. But he looked at it actually as that prison sentence actually saved his life. For the amount of years he was incarcerated, a lot of the, you know, he wasn't exposed to the lifestyle in which he was prior to being arrested. The only one regret he had was that he couldn't attend his mother's funeral. But he actually, he wasn't, he was just happy to be freed, and he said that it was God's will. And that's how he accepted it. I mean, I can't say the same if, God forbid, something like that was to happen to me. I don't know if I'd be that gracious. But we have to rely on the Almighty, and that's about it. That's all I can say, but that's it.
Okay. I would like to bring in 2 points now, gentlemen, and one is really springing off. We're still within the month of the Hebrew month of Adar, still the month that we celebrated the joyous holiday of Purim, and also in a couple of minutes also we're going to connect to the last 12 mitzvahs, commandments, which are the positive mitzvahs on how to speak properly and avoid lashon hara, evil speech. But gentlemen, and then hopefully also as well, even before that, I asked Dennis before we went on, Ram, to read a little from Guide to the Perplexed from page 226. I have no idea what it's going to be, so let's see how, if it's synchronistic or, you know, divine providence, he's going to read, and let's see if it really fits in with how the program is flowing. But gentlemen, I want to share with you this point. I learned this not this Shabbat yesterday, but the previous Shabbat. Going back to the book of Esther. Now, it's very interesting, you know, the book of Esther is about how the Jews faced a decree which is imposed upon by the wicked Haman, the Amalekite, and how they stood up to it by the righteousness of Mordechai and Esther, and actually the entire Jewish people who repented of the catalyst for their judgment was because they fell into a confusion where they lost their faith and certainty that there was a prophecy that was uttered 70 years before by the prophet Jeremiah, that the Yehudim, the Jewish people, would rebuild the second temple. So everything that changed out, their lack of faith or their confusion and uncertainty, led to the decree of Haman, who tossed a lot, and it came out that the day that he actually picked for the Jews to be annihilated in one day actually turned to be the day of deliverance for the Jewish people. So, gentlemen, you know, when we read the Megillah, the story of Esther, which is only 10 chapters, it can be read by anyone in, you know, half hour, depending on how fast they read. We see in the last chapter of the book of Esther, a very interesting statement. It's only 3 verses. It says the following. King Ahasuerus levied a tax on the mainland and the islands of the sea. All his mighty and powerful acts and the account of the greatness of Mordechai, who the king had promoted, are recorded in the book of Chronicles of Persia in those days, of the kings of Media and Persia. Okay, that was verse 1 and 2. And then verse 3, for Mordechai, the Jew, was viceroy, which means he was second in command to King Ahasuerus. He was a great man among the Jews and found favor with the multitude of his brethren, and he sought the good of his people and spoke for the welfare of all of his seed. Why am I bringing up these 3 verses, gentlemen? Well, the Babbage Rebbe, about 1967, elucidated that we have to go back. A problem that a lot of people have when they look at Scripture is they forget that the context of the ancient cultures of which these stories and these events, or historical events, occurred. So back then in the day of King Ahasuerus, as we see, that Mordechai, who was promoted, was a viceroy. Now, a viceroy in English has one connotation, but we understand it from the Hebrew Israelite Torah, is that we had another famous viceroy by the name of Joseph, who was actually a viceroy to Pharaoh in Egypt, and also in Hebrew, known as Mishneh LeMelech. He was second to the king. As Pharaoh said about Yosef, Joseph, the righteous one, no one can lift his hand without Joseph's permission, meaning he was totally in control. And the kings in those days, whether it be the time of Pharaoh, or approximately, 500-600 years later, in the time of Ahasuerus, the king himself, of those particular countries and those particular cultures in ancient times, they really didn't directly run the country. Basically, they would sign certain decrees, but basically the viceroy was the person, so to speak, who was running the country. We have something that's similar, say, like in the modern state of Israel, you have like a You have a president of Israel, but really the person who runs the country on an administrative level is the prime minister, like say Bibi Netanyahu, or you have in England you have the king and queen of England, or you know the royal house of England, but they don't really rule. They're basically just symbolic. But the prime minister and the parliament run. So we see that Mordechai was actually not King Achashverosh. The Lubavitcher explains, according to the oral tradition, that Mordechai levied a tax on the mainland and on Susa, and not Achashverosh. But since it was Achashverosh's kingdom, it was said that he levied the tax, meaning he agreed to the tax that Mordechai had levied. So why do we have to learn that Mordechai would levy such a tax? The Lubavitcher explains that Mordechai actually was doing that in order that the subjects of King Achashverosh's kingdom. We have to remember, gentlemen, he had a kingdom of 127 provinces, which ran from India all the way to Ethiopia. It was quite a large immense, basically the Middle East and North Africa. And Mordechai's intent, the Lubavitcher Rebbe reports, or explained, elucidated, based on oral Torah traditions, is that actually he wanted to create a judicial system where the laws would be followed and administered according to the 7 commandments, and the judges would be judges who would not be given into corruption and would be righteous judges. So you see, gentlemen, that with the oral Torah, we see that great insight was given. So this whole idea, the idea that I'm trying to share with other people, put on the table of discussion and meditation for other people, yourselves and others, these ideas are not new. They're going back 2,500 years. They're going back 3,320, almost 23 years with Moses. They're going back 4,414 years, the time of Noah, that there have always been attempts by individuals to try to enact statutes to promote justice so we could avoid this horrible Supreme Court justice decision. Dennis, your take on this, and then followed by Ron.
Well, you might call it horrible, but humans need a deciding factor because we can't keep splitting hairs and everybody has their own opinion. So we arbitrarily or by convention accept what is done. The Islamic world has a regular expression that's used by them, and it's called Inshallah. That means as God wills it. Just as Ron has said, God wills it, so be it. We can't do anything about it. We cannot reverse injustices, but we can go on for the future and hope that it will be better. So therefore, it isn't a question of accepting the injustice. It's a question of what are we going to do for tomorrow?
Right. Ron, your take on this subject matter?
Actually, I was actually reading something while you were going through. So we discussed this way before. So I took the liberty of going through one of the stories in the second book of Kings. So I really don't have much commentary on what you just said.
Go ahead.
It was a story of the prophet Elisha. When in the book of Kings, 2 Kings, I will give you the exact chapter 5, mm-hmm. chapter 5, verse 1, where there was a commander of the army of Aram. His name was Naaman. He was inflicted with leprosy.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the girls that was captured, an Israelite girl that was captured by the his king's raiding party, who she became a servant to his wife, informed him that if he wanted to be cured, he should seek the cure from the land of Israel.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, the prophet, the senior prophet there, was Elisha, who had just taken over the reins from Elijah. And it was just interesting that when he arrived and he sent for us, he obtained a letter from the king, and he took it, he gave this to the king of Israel. And the king of Israel, his first reaction was he went into fear because he himself, not being a prophet, just a king, assumed that it was a pretext for war, because how could he cure the, you know, commanding officer of leprosy? And he knew no idea of how to implement this cure. And at that point in time, the message was sent to Elisha, who approached him and said, "Send him to me. I will cure him." So when Naaman arrived at Elisha's gate and he made his announcement, he assumed that Elisha will come out and show him respect and, you know, basically bow down to him. And Elisha just gave a remedy to one of his messengers. He says, "Tell Naaman that he should immerse himself 7 times in the river." I think it was the Jordan River. And Naaman became very upset because he felt to himself that, you know, it should have been, you know, something probably more difficult or something more elaborate. And just immerse himself. He says, "There are rivers in Damascus. I could immerse myself there. Why come here and immerse myself?" And one of his guards said to him, "Master, if it was something extremely difficult, you would have done it. So should you not do it even though it's simple?" And he conceded. He decided to immerse himself 7 times. And the 7th time, he was cured.
Mm-hmm.
And it says that he offered Elisha, you know, all talents of silver, whatever it was, and Elisha refused. But he wanted something from Elisha. He says, "I would like to have a large amount of earth from Elisha's property in order to build my altar in my own town to God." And he says, you should forgive me, because whenever I'm next to the king, I have to bow down to his idols that he serves.
Mm-hmm.
But know that I will acknowledge that the one God is the God of Israel." And in the commentary, it says that he started observing the 7 Noahide laws. And the sacrifices he'd offer to the Creator were the Korban Ola, the burnt offerings in which Noahides are permitted to offer on their private altars. So that's...
So, he, you know, this person was very honest. You know, and I guess it's not so easy to be dishonest in front of a prophet, you know, a real prophet, because basically, I mean, I've met very high people that, you meet them, you realize it won't help to speak anything but the truth according to one's understanding. So, you know, and he was given feedback and he carried it out. And again, this is an instruction. What I'm concerned about is that, you know, we have in society a certain passivity which can only, I think at this point, can only be counteracted embraced or encountered, and maybe to even confronted on an intellectual, spiritual, emotional plane by, again, this type of dialogue. Because I think that, you know, people are so ensconced with what they call March Madness with the basketball. It's the opening day of baseball season. But, you know, people are going to the baseball games and the basketball games. And again, I'm not against people playing sports. I myself am an avid exercise enthusiast. But more people's lives in potential are going to be affected by, say, like a court case like this. Because, gentlemen, what it boils down to is, what is man's life worth? Now, you know, $14 million might seem like a lot of money, but what is the value of being incarcerated wrongly 18 years? In fact, I heard last night on the radio, actually there's a laboratory in Long Island that has been shut down, gone out of business, because it's been proven that there's a laboratory that would test people for substance abuse in cases which led to their prosecution. And enough evidence has been drawn up that actually their testing laboratory have engaged in many mistakes. So the question is now, is that going to open up a lawsuit against them? Because people could be sitting behind bars for charges of using narcotics when actually their blood levels indicated that they didn't have the substance in them. You know, again, so how does society profit by people wrongfully being put in jail on wrongful convictions. And that's another discussion we won't get into. Why are people getting wrongfully convicted? And the matter to be discussed is, you know, is it possible to actually upgrade the United States justice system or any justice system? Well, I would suggest if we don't talk about it, it never will improve. In fact, something that stays the same, more likely than not, gets worse. Dennis, your thoughts, feelings, concerns about how if things don't improve, they get worse in the human condition from your life experiences?
If people don't believe that there's hope for the future, then they start doubting what they're doing. Once they start doubting what they're doing, we're going to create more human problems. Those problems manifest themselves in many different ways. However, what is indisputable is the law of God is very clear. The law that humans put forth as what we're all going to follow is always susceptible to interpretation, change, variation. We have politics interfering, we have religious interference, and we have umpty other interferences. Humans are fickle. Over a period of history, we have changed many different laws in many different places, and we're great for rationalizing and creating exceptions. So much so, the exceptions start turning around and biting us in the backside and are called excuses. And we allow those excuses to come forward. Why? Because we say there's one human principle interfering with another. So to keep talking about the human problems, they're not going to go away. We can keep on talking about them. Long after we're gone, there'll be people discussing this. Maybe we should have done this. Maybe we should have done that. So I tend personally to stay away from these things that sometimes may be topical, may have value, but do they have real meaning? So I always go back to what did God want us to do on the planet here, not what other humans thought other humans would feel better at doing.
Right. Ron, your take on how does the human condition react when there's no sense of self-improvement or seeing improvement of others, on part of others or in society, or like in this case, you know, my concern is that if people learn about this case, they might come to more and more disrespect the justice system, and especially in time when, say, like Mayor Bloomberg wants to cut the number of police in the city, we don't want more chaos in the city. What's your take on all this, Ron, since you do work in New York City?
First of all, I also thought occurred to me that the reason why they probably denied him of this monetary reward is because they would set a precedent, and then it would be such a massive amount of lawsuits from all the wrongfully imprisoned people that it would really probably, you know, fiscally it would not be very helpful for the state's financial situation. So I feel those are one of the reasons why it probably did not want to award this money. I mean, there was a case where it was massive amounts of police brutality with the Abner Louima case here in New York. And
right.
He was actually awarded about, I think, $37 million, I think it was. A tremendous amount of money he was awarded.
Right.
But, I mean, a lot of rules and safeguards have been put in place in the law enforcement agency to prevent this from happening again, with people getting incarcerated because of evidence, new evidence or evidence withheld. This is something I'm not sure they can quite contain, and that's the reason why they're afraid to set a precedent of awarding huge sums of money to wrongfully convicted people. I mean, it's a shame because, you know, money can't even, you know, bring back the loss of the time that you've lost and the heart
right.
you've been through, especially the feeling inside knowing that you were not guilty. I think that's even worse. But I think to be even exonerated and for the world to and to be acknowledged that you are not the criminal, the world, I mean, the judicial system thought you were.
Right.
It kind of like satiates that to some extent. I mean, I thank God I was never in that position. I hope never to be or even know of anyone personally who have been. So, but even if we can minimize this down to a point where if we do something where other people assume we did something wrong and eventually we're exonerated, we feel a relief. We feel like a burden taken off that at least the truth came out. And in this sense, even though it was an injustice, at least the truth came out and it wasn't just buried permanently and just sealed forever, because they could have easily said, okay, nothing happened and let's leave him in there. Yeah, why admit the mistake? At least we've gotten to a level where we're admitting, and at least this man is freed. You know, a couple of years probably ago, he probably would have been in there for the rest of his life and nobody would say a word. So at least I think we've made a baby step towards at least admitting we're wrong. And hopefully with more DNA and all these different technology and testings that we have in place now, we'll try to prevent this from reoccurring to begin with. That's all I can say. But, you know, other than that, we must have hope. Otherwise, once people start losing hope, we start, you know, right now because of this radiation in Japan, that they're experiencing in Japan, and it's coming here. People are already, you can't even get an ounce of iodine to buy online anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And if this keeps escalating, what will happen is, you know, people will start panicking. And I think that one of the job of the government is always to try to maintain stability and calmness as much as they can. And there will be mistakes, and I know for sure that this will not change for the future. I mean, dramatically in the future, because we're only humans, and everything we do have it, you know, will be, you know, 90% right, and you know, 10%, you know, human error.
Well, so, my wish for Mr. Thompson is that this story, which I don't know if Rudy Stettner broke the story, it's probably. What he usually does is he goes to major media sources and then he gives his viewpoint, that major media sources will pick it up and hopefully someone from Hollywood pick it up to make a movie or a book. Someone will write a book about him, that somehow, if not through the court system or the U.S. justice system, which in this case did a great injustice, that somehow through major media, it would certainly make the makings of a great movie, and hopefully that would raise revenues for Mr. Thompson to give him some sort of comfort and respite for him, his family. I don't know if he was married with children or with other, but something, somehow from the, Hashem has, you know, they say when one door is shut, many will open. So hopefully Mr. Thompson will get some sort of compensation to remove the shame, the pain, whatever he went through. Gentlemen, we have a mystery caller in. Mystery caller, can you identify yourself?
Who's the mystery caller? Who's the mystery caller?
Hoffinger. Oh, Baruch Hoffinger Hakohen. Okay, Baruch,
I'm a mystery to myself also.
What's that?
I'm also a mystery to myself.
I hear you. But let's go on. Baruch, we'd like to hear your comments on the next subject matter we'd like to go into, which basically is, before the show, Blessed Souls, I asked Dennis Ryan to pull out page 226 arbitrarily from the Rambam's Guide to the Perplexed, and hopefully it would plug in synchronistically or from Divine Providence would fit right into the show like a hand fits into a glove. Dennis, could you please read for us from page 226 from Rambam's Guide to the Perplexed?
Well, you picked a good one, Don. That's in the middle of what the Rambam calls On Prophecy. And the Rambam is considered, yes, the Rambam is considered an authority in the world on prophecy, because he did a huge amount of research and he formulated a huge amount of theory, thought, and what is the practice of prophecy. I believe that there were 55 known prophets. 48 of them men, 7 women. I thought Esther was one of those women who was in the prophets. That was not only Rambam, but also it's in the Megillah if you want to look it up. However, Rambam did state that he has opinions, not necessarily he was preaching that this was the word, but his opinion. Now, he separated what he said as it relates to the Talmud, the Bible, and all the holy scriptures as to his own thoughts. So he was very careful on saying what was his opinion. But anyway, let me read from page 226. He said, there are two modes of prophecy, vision and dream, include all its different degrees. It is a well-known fact that the thing which engages greatly and earnestly man's attention whilst he is awake and in full possession of his senses forms, during his sleep, the object of the action of his imaginative faculty. Imagination is then only influenced by the intellect in as far as it is predisposed for such influence. It would be quite useless to illustrate this by a simile or explain it fully. It is clear, and everyone knows, it is like that action of the senses, the existence of which no person with common sense would ever deny. After these introductory remarks, you will understand that a person must satisfy the following conditions before he can become a prophet. The substance of the brain must be from the very beginning to be of a most perfect condition as regards purity of matter, composition of its different parts, size, and position. So, no part of his body must suffer from ill health. He must be, in addition, having studied and acquired wisdom so that his rational facility passes from state of potentiality to that of actuality. His intellect must be developed and perfect as human intellect can be. His passions pure and equally balanced. All his desires must aim at obtaining a knowledge of the hidden laws and causes that are in force in the universe. His thoughts must be engaged in lofty manners, his attention directed to the knowledge of God, the consideration of his works, and that of which he must believe in this respect. One second, please.
Beautiful. Yeah, go ahead.
But he not only said this, but he said that the world of prophecy is over because the last known prophet was around 313 B.C. And his opinion now, not necessarily that he's preaching that it must be believed, because it is opinion, is that the next time a prophecy will occur, if it does at all, will be during the Messianic period, when the Messiah comes and cleanses the world and redeems everything.
Amen. Amen. Beautiful. I just want to bring out, Dennis, that from my studies that, yes, in the pure, pristine, 100% presentation of prophecy, we have that tradition that, like you said, from basically the closing of the period a little after the story of Esther, you had prophets like Daniel walking around, Mordechai, Esther, Zechariah, Mishael, Azariah, Hananiah. You had also Ezra the scribe, who was instrumental in leading a very small band of Jewish people to ultimately rebuild the Second Temple. But that doesn't preclude what has manifested through the ages, which has been discussed by various sages of Israel, that qualities of prophecy have been existed until today. In fact, so to speak, the cousin or the younger sister of prophecy is something what is known as Ruach HaKodesh, divine inspiration. So, so to speak, like, I'll give a very crude allegory. If any one of us are old enough, I mean, Dennis probably remembers, I'm old enough to remember, there was a baseball player by the name of Lou Gehrig who hit 493 home runs, which was a tremendous amount of home runs in his day, played until 1939. But his number was dwarfed by the amount of home runs Babe Ruth hit, which were 714, over 221 more home runs. So in that sense, this is pun intended, because we just started opening day of baseball season. Yeah, we can learn something from baseball. So Babe Ruth, so to speak, was at the prophetic, profound level of hitting home runs. And Lou Gehrig, his numbers were dwarfed anyone's numbers coming close to him, aside from maybe one or two other players during that era. But, yeah, his ability to produce, that experience, which is, you know, for many people is a euphoric experience, the home run, so to speak. So to speak, there is there's that sense of the home run, the absolute clear prophecy, and then there is the lower diminished perception of the prophecy, which is more, the difference is basically, from what I understand, gentlemen, and then any of you are certainly welcome to chime in on, that the prophecy is where the person who is the prophet has basically made himself into a loudspeaker system for the Most High's wisdom. The person who has Ruach HaKodesh has basically refined their mind to the point where they can get insights which don't make them just a loudspeaker system, but they are able to give over a perception based on their intellectual perception and not deviate one iota from what the divine intent is in that instruction. Ron, your take on prophecy and divine inspiration as you've encountered it in your studies of Torah?
Honestly speaking, it was not until recently then. Recently, I think it was in the, I don't remember if it was Derech Hashem, the ways of the just, or the path of the way, I think it was in the way to God, when it was actually described there, where that the prophet, besides Moshe was the only prophet who was in total awareness of himself and all his faculties when he received the prophecy. All the other prophets, I think, were their mental faculties and their senses were basically suspended when they received the prophecy. Ruach HaKodesh, I've been conquered, but the scenario is really like my mother would say, you know, Ron, I have a funny feeling, I don't know if it's intuition or whatever, or something said to me that this is not a good idea or you shouldn't do this, and you see later on that, you know, what she said was actually right. So, it wasn't that prophetic, but it was like she just had the vibe, as you would say. So I don't know if that's like a form of Ruach HaKodesh or heightened awareness or intuition. Honestly speaking, I'm not very clear on the subject. I don't know.
Okay, very good. Would you like to chime in, Baruch, on Ruach HaKodesh and Nevuah? Prophecy and divine inspiration.
Yeah. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you clearly.
I'm a little under the weather here. Listen, that sounds like something we learned. It's called Bina Yetera. So what's the difference between Bina Yetera and Ruach HaKodesh?
What is Bina Yetera? Explain what Bina Yetera means, Brooke, because people don't understand necessarily the Hebrew you're speaking.
I don't exactly know. I know that it's called intuition in English.
Right. Okay.
So higher, I don't know exactly what it is. I don't think
it can also be explained as additional understanding. Simply speaking, simply meaning more under a person who has Bina Yetera, which is actually
right.
A trait which is attributed to women, is that the women are more intuitive than men. Men are more analytical. Of course, these are just basic paradigms, and we're not locking anyone into a deterministic mode that women have to be more intuitive and men have to be analytical, because I've met women who are more analytical than men, and I've met some men who are more intuitive than women. So we're not, you know, just saying it's basically these are, so to speak, embedded in the male species and female species, but neither species, male or female, are bound by these type of axioms. What else do you want to add, Bruch?
Well, the Torah says women have been in your terror, so there probably more women that have this than men.
Right. Right.
So what's the difference between Bina Yetera, I don't know, and Ruach HaKodesh?
Well, I think Ruach HaKodesh is something a little bit beyond that. As far as
I'll tell you an experience I had.
If you can make it quick.
Okay, in 71, I was going to college. I wanted to be an architect, so I was going to Brooklyn.
Baruch?
Yeah? Can you hear me?
Oh, go ahead. Yeah, there was a break. It sounded like we lost you for a second.
Oh, maybe I moved it from my mouth a little bit. I'm sorry. And 1 minute. Here. Can you hear me now?
I can hear you. You have to speak.
Okay, I have the speaker on here. Wait a minute, seeing which is better. Okay, now you can hear me?
We can hear you.
All right, so I was very troubled by the Holocaust. So the bus stopped at Foster and Ocean Avenue in Brooklyn to change for the one where I lived to go to my home in Borough Park. So I'd seen photos of Holocaust. I saw a picture of a mound of children's shoes, and my heart was broken. I had little or no religious education. The bus comes. I didn't get on the bus. And I'm wondering, where is God? Why did he let all these little people get slaughtered? So I stood there at the bus stop at Foster and close to Flatbush and Ocean Avenue. And I said, God, if there's a God in the world, show me if you exist or not. And then I realized, if there's a God in the world, you have to humble yourself. So I humbled myself. And then I felt as if something incredible were about to happen. As I'm standing there virtually alone with light traffic around me, automobile traffic, suddenly something great was about to happen. And then, not far from the intersection, right next to an animal hospital that's over there, the air like hollowed out, like a huge sphere, 40 feet wide, I don't know, 30 feet wide. And all of a sudden, hovering over the intersection, all of a sudden, all of the cars, the people, everything in the whole area got sucked up into it, became one mass in front of my eyes,
mm-hmm.
and started to rotate slowly, and I started to cry. I gained some kind of knowledge that Hashem Echad, God is one. And then I started to go back in time, and I got very frightened. I wanted to stop it. I really I could have stopped this whole process. And I went back. I became a baby in the cradle. And it was very live and real to me. And then I kept going further back, and I was terrified. It felt like millions of years passed, but it was probably only a couple of seconds.
Hmm.
And I went into the earth, and as I stood there, I'm a little groggy. I realized that if there's a God, you have to humble yourself. So I said to Hashem, oh God, I didn't know the name Hashem then. I just said, God, I knew the name was God. I said, God, if you exist, make those children alive and take my life now, right this second. That's when the whole process happened. So I was willing to give my life, to die. So I had a little bit of a moment, you know? And Jews or others have had this throughout ages.
Sure. All peoples have had, you know, those, certainly, I mean.
Yeah, so then I went into the ground.
All righteous people of all nations.
Yeah. So then I kept going back, and I went into the ground. After I became a baby, I kept going back. I was terrified. So I went into the ground. I became part of the whole earth and the whole universe. There was no difference. I was it, and it was me, and I was it. And there's more to it, but it gets very scary. I'll stop.
Okay, let's leave it at that. Dennis, your take on all of this.
Well, I want to go back to something that you mentioned, Don, and you called Daniel a prophet. There is a body in Judaism that doesn't list Daniel as a prophet. However, in another work by Rambam called The Days of the Messiah, he says that Daniel predicted that Jesus of Nazareth would appear. But be that as it may, it was just lingering around in my head. And when you said the word Daniel, a couple of clicks, no, okay? However, you had originally asked me to say something from page 226 of Guide to the Perplexed, and I would like to follow it up with just one sentence from 227, page 227, directly from the Rambam, and it says, In the Masonic period, may it soon commence, prophecy will therefore again be in our midst, as has been promised by God. That's a profound statement, and when the Rambam makes those statements, you have to give it a lot of extra thought.
Right. In fact, I like to chime in on it that the Lubavitch Rebbe mentioned that even though we don't see prophets walking around, I'm paraphrasing him, however, we can go to Rambam's Laws of the Foundations of the Torah, where I think there's three or four chapters where one can learn what is, according to Torah standards, a prophet, and the learning of those halachas, those laws, actually might inspire people, if not to become a prophet, because one just, you know, a person doesn't become a prophet like one's earning a graduate degree or a PhD in spirituality, but rather the idea of the essential point of a prophet is a refined human being who is distanced from the darkness and the confusions of the age that he or she might live in. They don't follow, meaning you wouldn't see, quote unquote, a real prophet, you know, getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning to buy a new iPad at 6 o'clock in the morning at the latest, you know. We're not going to see him do that or want to get opening day tickets to any baseball game. Gentlemen, now let's go to the commandments about proper speech, because, again, the show is about the healing of America via the faculty of speech, not just for America, but for the creation, for ourselves, for everyone listening in. And the third positive mitzvah as it relates to the laws of Lashon Hara, negative speech, which really ties in synchronistically, or you might say divine providence manner. If we go to the book by the Chafetz Chaim called Netzar Lashoncha, Guard Your Tongue, we see that there is a commandment written in the book of Leviticus, which writes the following in chapter 19, verse 15. It says following: "Betzedek tishvur amitecha, in righteousness you shall judge your neighbor." So the Chafetz Chaim elaborates, this verse obligates us to give someone the benefit of the doubt when we see him performing an action that could be interpreted in his favor. So if an average person who is engaged in the commandments of the Most High does or says something, and the chances of a favorable judgment and unfavorable judgment are equal, we must grant him a favorable judgment. If the person in question is a person who has fear of the Most High, we must judge him, now let's put slash her, favorably, even if the unfavorable side outweighs the favorable one. If you assume that this person's action was improper and you relate it in a manner to others, besides violating the prohibition of Lashon Hara, you also violate this commandment. Often, a narrative may consist of entirely true facts, but because the action or words referred to were taken out of context, a completely distorted picture is conveyed. Also, many things are said or done in anger that under normal circumstances would not have been said or done. It is unfair to judge such incidents without taking the circumstances into consideration. So, gentlemen, this is deep stuff because, you know, the Torah is not advocating someone to, you know, not look at the truth of the matter, but also go into the context, or perhaps the environment, I'm going to add, or which that person was in when they committed an act which could be interpreted favorably. Like, for instance, I call it the injustice of the Supreme Court, and Ron saying it's perhaps maybe a move in the right direction. Gentlemen, Dennis, or you know, I've been starting with Dennis. Ron, let's start off with you. What is your take on this commandment, and how can we implement this in our daily lives in righteousness, judging our neighbor properly?
I think that was one of the moves that caused the, that's from the mode of thinking which caused the suspension of the death penalty, even though many times we would love to see that enacted. But many times these people who commit certain crimes, I think the justice system tend to look at the type of environment and the situation prior to them committing certain acts, and as a result have suspended the death penalty for reasons like this. Also, many people we see get off on the, you know, in insanity plea and stuff like that. So I guess I'm not even sure if this really works in actuality as it should, because many people cop out on these types of pleas and whatever it is. But I still think it's a step in the right direction. Like the babies we've been stepping all along throughout history, as Dennis had just said, that, you know, throughout history we're enacting laws, we're removing, we're updating. So I think we're hopefully, and I'm very hopeful that we are heading in the right direction, and we do have to look at all the circumstances. Whenever a person does something not right, and there's a lot of motivating factors behind it, and with all things considered, only after that then we are able to really make an honest and you know, right judgment. But one more thing I have to say, unfortunately, I have to leave you now. So thank you very much for having me on the class. And Dennis, thank you. Have a great week. Baruch, have a beautiful week. And Dan?
Be well, Ron.
Take care.
Thank you, Ron. That was Ron Williams, Noah Hyde, scholar.
Thank you.
And advocate, teacher, friend, all around great guy. Okay, Dennis, would you like to chime in?
Yes. We humans are imperfect, and we live in an imperfect world. We cannot seek perfect justice. I mean, we can try to seek justice, but we will never get it right. We can come close, but that doesn't mean we should stop seeking justice. Because if we don't have the hope that justice will be in the future, then we start losing a lot of our basic values of life. So, yes, we can seek justice and try to get it the best way we can. We're not perfect. We make mistakes. But as long as we keep trying, we'll be on the right track.
Mm-hmm. Baruch, I know this is a hot issue by you, justice and injustice in the justice system. What's your take on this? And how can we better implement in righteousness judging our fellow, our neighbor?
Oh. I guess if we're seeing the fault, the Baba Chirebi spoke about that. You know, if we're aware of the fault in ourselves, then, and we know sometimes we didn't do things intentionally, we should judge the other person the same way. And just like we want to be judged for the merit, when we see somebody do something we don't know the exact reason, we should try to tend to be fair-minded with them. Now, you go into shul, you see someone talking during, like a man came over to me in the shul, being a coin, and he wanted a blessing from me. I give him a blessing, him and his family. And then the laning in shul, the prophets, and he's talking constantly. He doesn't respect the Jewish prophets. So I got really annoyed, you know. I said, well, what do you think? God is a fool. He wants a blessing from God, so to speak. It wasn't from me. It's from God. So I'm like a conduit. And then he goes and he doesn't respect the prophets. And his kids learn from this, that the prophets aren't so important. It's just like his friend down the block. But I thought to myself, look, he doesn't have much he doesn't have much understanding of godliness, das. He doesn't appreciate what the Haftorah is. Maybe he never learned, because a lot of people in this community, newly religious, don't learn about prophets so much. We don't have time. We learn Hasidus, Allah, Jewish law, and things like that. You know, the Mishnah Torah, Talmud. I thought to myself, he doesn't have much understanding. Doesn't feel it and sense it enough. Mm. But you got to rely on your judgment.
Look, something, you know, someone when you're talking, it's like you're fading in and out.
How's that better?
Get off the speaker.
Yeah, that's better. I know. It's just, I changed phones also. Speaker on the other
on
works
this
well.
Phone.
This one doesn't.
Don't switch. Listen, if you switch back the other one.
I had to. I didn't want to use up my time on the other phone. This is a house phone.
Oh, I'm
now.
Sorry. Okay.
So am I. I'm Baruch. Where'd you get that name? It's a joke.
No, come on. Continue.
Yeah. So I, when you see something doing like that, you feel you delved into the prophets yourself, and I'm a Kohen, so I have a blessing in the spirituality, you know what I'm saying? Above the next guy. Because I'm a Kohen, I have some kind of a understanding or feeling, a sensing of Kedusha, of holiness, more than the next one. It's in my genes, whatever you want to call it, you know. So you got to lighten up on the next person. You know, if you're knowledgeable about something and something's weak in it, and they're working for you or something like that, you give them a chance because they're new to the field. So you have to have a little compassion, a little understanding, even though it's basically wrong and it's sending a bad message to his kids. I was sitting and watching him talk. You know.
Right. Okay, very good. Let's go on to
Don,
the next. Yes, Dennis.
We have some expressions that we've learned over the years that have been taught to us. One of those is, suffer the fools.
There are fools out there. We got to put up with them, but we suffer with them. We don't call them bad names. We don't put them in jail. We just hope that they'll come around and see the light. But besides that, judgment is reserved for the Lord. We all know that. So we, as humans, being imperfect, have to be very careful how we judge others, because can we use the same judgment on ourselves? So that has always been one of those intriguing philosophical questions, that if you want to start judging people very carefully, you can be held up to the same judgment. Would you able to bear that judgment or not?
Excellent point.
Your original statement that you said contains a lot of wisdom, but we have to be very careful in our judgment.
Very good. And, you know, the sixth Lubavitch Rebbe, known as the Rebbe Rayatz, the Yosef Yitzhak Schneerson, I believe I once read something, teaching me, and he said the following: the right side of the right eye is considered to be the line on a Kabbalistic or interdimensional perception of Torah as the perception of kindness. The left eye or left side is the judgmental one. So he said that's why we were given two eyes. We were given the right eye to judge favorably others, and the left eye to look back at ourselves and be more stern with ourselves and be judgmental of ourselves. So we make the practice of judging ourselves more than we judge others, or judging others favorably and really taking ourselves to task, and hopefully we can avoid from, you know, crisscrossing the instruction, looking at people with the left eye and thinking too kindly of ourselves. Hopefully we'll be better rectified human beings. With that being said, gentlemen, I'd like to move into the next commandment, which is coming from Leviticus 25, chapter 25, verse 35, which says the following: if your brother is poor and his means of support have failed when he is with you, then you should uphold him and give support. So the Chafetz Chaim elaborates that the Torah obligates us to give financial aid, in this particular context, a fellow Jew, but in a moment we're going to expand it to how it applies to Noahides as well, and Jews to Noahides and Noahides to Jews, in order to prevent his becoming poor. This could be the form of a grant, a loan, or a source of income. And the Rambam, teaching in the laws of presents for the poor, mentions that if a person speaks badly, as a consequence, the person who one spoke about loses job or income, one has violated this commandment. So not only has one spoken negatively and somehow will be taken to task, they've actually caused the ruination, the further ruination of a person who's trying to get back on their feet. Now, in this particular context in Leviticus, it's talking about among Jewish people. However, Baruch Hashem, thank God, we have the oral tradition, which talks in the oral Torah, it talks about the necessity of Jewish people also helping the Noahides, and under what conditions that Jewish people are allowed to get, you know, financial assistance from Noahides, okay, in reverse, and also pertaining to eventually when we resettle the land of Israel, and Halavai, it should only be right now, like this in our days right now, that if there was true peace among the Jews and the Arab Islamic peoples, or Christian peoples as well, the Christian Arabic peoples over there, that if the Noahide Arabic peoples would keep the seven Noahide commandments, which would preclude any need for further battles, combats, violent actions taken on both sides, that actually the Jewish people living in Israel would be mandated by the Torah to actually support the Arabic peoples over there. So Dennis, what's your take on, and also I want to mention one more thing that's brought down in the oral Torah tradition, that actually that charity serves as a means of atonement. And in the prophet Ezekiel, it's mentioned as well that Sodom and Gomorrah were not destroyed merely because of their wickedness, but because of their lack of kindness one to the other. Dennis, what is your take on these matters, and any suggestions for anyone how to try to avoid undercutting another person's financial stability? And what can we do to try to help people, at least with speech, to try to help people in these rough economic times? It's a pretty loaded question.
Not really. Good times or bad times, we should be trying to help our fellow man or our fellow human. Should we look at what label or tag is on them? No. God created them, that we're all creatures of God. And when we start acting like that, the earth will be a better place. Unfortunately, people keep emphasizing what is our differences. However, people who are in need, regardless of what the condition is, we should be there to help them. It's inherent in the human nature to be with people. We weren't designed to stand alone. We were designed to stand with other people. And you must be aware of that. So therefore, if and when we can help people in forms of monetary, mental reinforcement, in some type of kindness, charity, or anything else, even a smile works. A handshake or whatever. People who are history is full of people who are passing in the desert, don't know each other, and they say hello to each other. Now, do people don't even do that to their neighbors? Or if you live in an apartment building, do you say hello to everybody when you go up and down the stairs of the elevator? No, I guess you're waiting for the other person to say hello. Apparently, we need to be motivated or made more aware that we're responsible or we have a relationship to other humans. We are not alone. God is with us, and he said, respect everything that I've created. If we don't practice it, then what are we thinking?
Right. Gentlemen, I have a surprise guest, and I think I know it is. Is this from the Village of Light, Mordechai Ben Mosey, Mordechai Santek, on the other end of our line?
Yes, sir. Good morning, everyone.
Well, Mordechai, I have to chant it. Mordechai Ben Mosey, ta na 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 na. Hey!
Hey!
Mordechai, we have Brooke Hoffinger and Dennis Ryan. Gentlemen, Mordechai just got over a wicked flu or virus, so we're glad to have him back with Vin Vigor. And Mordechai, I want to remind you, with 15 minutes left to go, in that 15 minutes, you could be saving more than 15% on organic horse manure. That's right. We are pitching organic horse manure at www.what? Come get your organic horse manure now, because a world without organic horse manure is a world without good fertilizer. Mordechai, your comment on that.
All I can say is that horse manure is what I say.
No, I think a little more than that. Mordechai, what's your take on we have to try to support our brethren, whether it be Jewish,
yes,
or Noahide, and we can't speak against them in a way that would undercut their financial livelihood.
Exactly. You know, this is why I called in. Really appreciate all of your comments here on this show. This show actually is a work for humanity. Because what I realized the other day, I was listening to the President of the United States' speech before we went into Libya, and what he said was that the seven universal human laws should be implemented in Libya.
Really?
So yes, that's what he said, Don. That's what he said. This was very amazing.
Wow.
When I've heard that, I said, man, is he listening to Don's shows or what? So, on that same note, what I was thinking, you know, I'm really interested in politics, and I'm really following everything and all that. And what I've seen is that financially, what really happens is when the news media, now I'm going to talk about Israel, when the news media is talking about Israel and how aggressive, you know, especially the British media, we all know the history of why the British media is talking negatively about Israel, because before Israel had become Israel, it was British territory under military rule. So what we see is that the liberal media, especially, is talking against Israel a lot and about our, you know, what we are doing negatively, et cetera, et cetera. But it never mentions the terror attacks, the evil acts that has been committed against our people in Israel. Now, this went so far that in political circles, they're talking about to cut the aid to Israel via the U.S. aid that is traveling over there every year.
Right.
So in higher places, it is also true that when somebody is judging one person or a nation just by on a one-sided note and never see the whole story, never see why that person is doing the things that he is doing, then it is possible that that it undercuts his financial abilities. It is true on with a nation also. Now with Muslim nations, when I look at the same thing, you know, we have to understand that there's a radical element to Islam, and it's not all Muslims that are, you know, negatively charged against us Jews or Western democracy. So, but the issue is that I fall into this trap also a lot of times whenever I see any negative thing coming out of the radical element of Islam, that I get truly upset and I start to judge all Islamic nations as a whole as evil in my heart. But then, you know, I have to remind myself that this judgment, you know, it can turn me into also a radical. You know, it could turn the human being into a hateful person by judging everyone. No, we should not judge everyone. We should not judge the people that are following a certain faith. Although I do not agree with that Muhammad was a prophet, you know, or anything like that, but we can just judge the evil deed and those teachings that are turned upside down from their Quran. So that's what I, you know, wanted to just, you know, join in with.
I want to make a comment that I heard on the radio this week. For instance, you know, horrible things coming out of Libya that were like women who have been molested and then want to raise their voice publicly are then accused of being prostitutes and then get jailed and further molested. On the other hand, too, I heard on another radio station that actually this week we saw the launching of two. Now, everyone's, you know, it's a very, I call it very superficial. I don't know how positive a magazine it is, but we'll call a spade a spade. Cosmopolitan magazine now is written in two Arabic forms. One is in a more modern sense, and actually Al-Qaeda, of all organizations, has actually come up with a, you know, Muslim, conservative view. Well, yeah, you've seen it, but I mean, you know, it's in Arabic, you know, to make so to speak, to bring these two divergent views, the modern view of Islam and the, quote-unquote, I don't know if it's traditional, but the more militaristic and...
The Wahhabi rule.
The Wahhabi, if that's what it is. I mean, again, I'm not going to analyze either magazines. I won't even try to understand it because I don't read Arabic. But it is interesting that there is a decisive battle for the consciousness of devout Muslims all over the world. And we do know that people who are Muslims here in America... Not a lot of them come out publicly and say that we don't hold by the Al-Qaeda faction, we don't hold by the Brotherhood of Islam faction, the Brotherhood of Islam, Islamic Brotherhood. You know, there either are moderates, you know, and even within that moderation, again, we're trying to bring out this point from the show is that whatever their point is, you know, if they're going to move hopefully in a positive direction, they should not find anything which contradicts their Islamic faith or, say, Christian faith or Buddhist faith or Hindu or Shinto, whatever faith you want to say, to integrate these seven axiomatic principles of how to connect to the Most High, which we already delineated at the beginning of the show. I'm not going to go into it. Dennis, what's your take on all this?
The take on all this is that when religion or theology becomes a personal viewpoint, we run into human type of problems. We were given our beliefs from God, and if we don't reinforce them, we get distracted, and we end up splitting hairs about this, that, and the other thing, and we end up with something that was just on the internet, even just this morning,
whereby a young woman was raped. She complained about it, and the local inman issued a fatwa that said she should really be punished. She was. She was given several hundred lashes, but she
Ooh.
Fainted halfway through it, and inside of a couple of days, she died in the hospital because of the lashings. Now, if you want to blame the victim or make the victim go away, that makes everything nice. Is this people believing that there's a human erasure, that we can erase these things? No, we must face reality. And the sooner we start facing reality, the quicker we can handle these problems. But in the meanwhile,
yeah.
we have distractions from here to kingdom come. And that's why Mordecai was trying to explain how we're going to judge it, what the politicians do, what the media does. Are they really interested in the truth, or are they interested in selling their opinion? If their opinion was closer to God, I might believe them even more. But apparently it's not. So we're going to constantly have this problem. If you were to pick up a newspaper from 100 years ago, you'd see similar problems all over the place. We humans just can't get away from solving some of our problems.
Right. Now, I want to inject some perception. I just pulled this off of a table in my congregation, the Frankel Shul in Brooklyn, New York. Let me just try to pull it out here. Well, there was actually government statistics, gentlemen, which pointed out that in 2010, that actually there was apparently the government had a way of registering those people involved in acts of kindness, acts of volunteerism in America, and there's about close to 300 million people living in this country. Well, according to this government website, there were actually 62,800,000 people who engaged in acts of volunteerism in America. Now, I hope that this type of information will get out, not just in America, but in all sectors of all human society, for people to look back on those statistics. So let's say in the Middle East right now, you have 250, maybe 300 million Islamic, Arabic, Christian Arabic people. Or in Africa, you have, I think 750 million. Let's say 30% of the continent of Africa got into some sort of spirit of volunteerism, or in, say, in the Arabic countries, 30% got involved. Can you imagine all of a sudden you're going to see a shift of close to, 250 million, close to maybe 300 million people getting involved in acts of kindness and volunteerism in the Middle East and Africa. I think this would be even a great, and I'm not downplaying what's going on because I don't want to decry anyone's attempt to get honest freedom. But can you imagine, gentlemen, if 300 million people all of a sudden the next year start engaging in acts of kindness and volunteerism in the African and Middle Eastern continents? And we got about 4 minutes to go. Let Dennis make a one-minute comment, then Mordechai, then we'll sign off. Mordechai, Dennis, please, what's your take on that?
I personally believe in people. I believe people have a conscience. I believe in that conscience. Deep down, they're willing to help. How they do it in their own way. But people will help, and I have faith in people.
Beautiful. Mordechai.
Hello?
What's your take on almost 63 million people in America getting involved in
right.
acts of volunteerism in 2010.
Wow, that's
Hello.
Beautiful. Yeah, somebody's on the line also.
Hey, Brooke, you'll also get a chance. Let's give Mordechai a minute and then you.
Okay.
All
yeah.
Right.
All I can say is one thing. The people has usually the people are like we are like herd like sheep, you know, like a flock. So the thing is, we are going wherever a shepherd is leading us towards to, most people. So the thing is, in the Middle East, in Africa, and in the Arabic nations, if there would be a change in leadership that would say, this is it, we are not doing the things that we've been doing for so long, we're not going to... do a stoning of women, killing homosexuals, etc., etc., etc. but we will act as a Western democratic country or a Western democratic Islamic, you know, world collectively, then this whole thing can change. But until it happens, it's not going to change. It's all about the leaders. That's all I can say.
Well, what about this, Mordechai? What if all of a sudden the spirit of voluntarism and kindness permeated to the point where 20% of the nations or countries, all of a sudden, they put down the weapons and start helping each other? I mean, I'm speaking very idealistically.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think would happen over there?
What could happen is it would be a huge change, but it's always coming from the head. If the head, the leader, does not give out the commandment to the flock, hey, charity, people, charity, show some kindness, show some love to your neighbor, even if it's a Jew, because obviously they hate us. Love them, love us, love these people. The Torah is coming from them. Muhammad would have not come if the Torah would have not existed. People, come on, show some. It's been thousands and thousands of years ago when we had made up how evil the Jews were. Now we understand that it was all a children's tale. Let's act kindly. And, you know, it's about the leaders, because right now there's so much brainwash. The brainwash spread so much on the Middle East that if you ask a Muslim if he would shake hands with a Jew, he would say no, he would not shake his hands, because then he would have to amputate his hands. And this is the attitude. So it's, if the leaders would change the attitude of the people, it would be a huge difference, Don.
Okay, thank you, Mordechai. Brooke, 30 seconds.
First of all, we talked about leadership. The president himself is guilty of a... when Washington was in Postville, and before the trial, you made a public statement, according to Nathan Lawrence, Lubashkin's lawyer, be kind to an employee, impugning Lubashkin, which wasn't true when he... So the president...
Looks like we lost Brooke. Gentlemen, I'm sorry, I lost Baruch. Gentlemen, we're going to sign off with a song by Yitzhak Paton, "The King is in the Field." Ladies and gentlemen, the Most High is in the field. I want to thank Mordechai, Ben Mosey, Sontag, Dennis Ryan, and Baruch Hoffinger. We lost, unfortunately, it was a bad connection. We'll end up with a part of the song, "The King is in the Field." The Most High is everywhere, blessed souls, not just in the field. Have a blessed week, and let's continue in this vibing in the healing of America via the faculty of speech. Take care, everyone.
Baruch Hashem.